You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
The Christians in Galatia have gotten off track in a variety of ways, and Paul is none too pleased. I can almost picture him pacing back and forth and waving his arms in exasperation as his scribe desperately tries to keep up. In fact, at the end, right after our passage for today in chapter 6, you can see just Paul grabbing the stylus from his assistant. And to make the point of how aggravated he is, he takes the added step of personally writing, "See with what large letters I am writing, with my own hand." I mean, the Galatians were in trouble. Our passage today addresses just one of the ways some of the Galatians were evidently misbehaving, by using their freedom for their own self-indulgent purposes.
Galatians 5:13 to 15. "For you were called to freedom, brothers and sisters, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for self-indulgence, but through love become slaves to one another. For the whole law is summed up in a single commandment: you shall love your neighbor as yourself."
For you were called to freedom, brothers and sisters, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for self-indulgence, but through love become slaves to one another. Some translations soften the word slaves to servants, but remember, Paul is essentially reaming out the Galatians for being self-indulgent. And that's one of the dangers of the idea of freedom. Taken in its most selfish sense, a proponent of an "it's all about me" kind of freedom is likely to say, "Don't you tell me what to do," like people can actually live out their lives in isolation from one another.
There is what I call the American idea, this idea of a democracy. That is, a government of all people, by all people, for all the people. Of course, a government of the principles of eternal justice, the unchanging law of God. For shortness' sake, I will call it the idea of freedom.
Of the people, by the people, for the people. You may associate that phrase with Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, but Lincoln actually lifted it from one of Theodore Parker's sermons. A government that embraces freedom as a value can only do so if it embraces justice first. In his letters to the Corinthians, Paul writes, "For freedom Christ has set us free." Paul was not anticipating the American Revolution or the Republic that grew up after it, but Paul was nevertheless a revolutionary. In fact, the freedom of which Paul was speaking was far more revolutionary than what the founders of our country spoke of. It was a freedom that would allow each of us to pursue the kingdom of God. And since Peter Gomes, preacher to Harvard University, has said, "Citizens who take both their country and their faith seriously should be encouraged to think about the purpose of freedom," that's exactly what we're going to do.
Whatever makes people good Christians makes them good citizens.
Democracy is nothing but an attempt to apply the principles of the Bible to a human society.
Paul tells us that the purpose of our freedom is that we be servants of one another. But more than that, literally slaves of one another, loving our neighbor as ourselves.
Paul says, "For freedom Christ has set us free, free to love, free to express our faith as devoted servants to our neighbors. Happiness comes as we give of ourselves away in faith and in love."
But be careful. Our devotion to freedom can become self-indulgent. After all, we're free. It's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? In the call to celebration that we opened with, George Washington's prayer for us is that ours is a happy country. Happiness. Doesn't that continue to be our prayer for ourselves, for our children, for our families, for our loved ones?
We need to be reminded that happiness is a byproduct. It's not an end in itself. Booker T. Washington said, "If you want to lift yourself up, lift up someone else."
For freedom, Christ has set us free. For you were called to freedom, brothers and sisters. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for self-indulgence, but through love become slaves to one another. For the whole law is summed up in a single commandment: you shall love your neighbor as yourself.
The principle of American democracy is that you have freedom. The question is, how will you use it? Which is also the central question in jazz. And in both democracy and in jazz, you have freedom with restraint. It's not absolute freedom. It's freedom with a structure. And in the immortal words of theologian Aretha Franklin, "You need me, and I need you. Without each other, there ain't nothing either can do." But if you think about it, that's the only way we can truly have freedom. 180 years ago, Alexis de Tocqueville visited our country from France and wrote the classic Democracy in America. One of the things that amazed him was the way Americans used their individual freedom for the common good. De Tocqueville called it a dangerous freedom. You don't know what you're unleashing. If people can use their gifts and exercise their freedom together, what a great society we can have, not unlike the kingdom of God that Paul would open our hearts and wills to. This is the dangerous freedom that attracted the founders. They knew deep down that this idea was a primal one, so primal that Paul even says it's at the heart of what Jesus was on about. So the founders, although not Christian, could see a virtue when it was staring them in the face.
Few of the founders were practicing Christians, but they respected the teachings of Jesus the man and would not be surprised by the fact that the United States Congress begins every session with organized prayer.
Nor would they be surprised that the Supreme Court issues rulings from a bench beneath an inscription of the Ten Commandments carved in granite.
They probably would be surprised that in 1955, the motto, "In God We Trust," was ordered put on all currency by an act of Congress and chosen as our national motto by an act of Congress in 1956. Their principal commitment was to the concept of freedom, one that gave people the choice to trust in God or not.
Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
The founders were mostly deists who respected the idea of Christianity, but for the most part found its practice to be embarrassingly lacking when compared with Jesus' original intent.
Thomas Jefferson, for instance, affirmed that he was a materialist, recognizing in Christianity only a particular superstition, a superstition without one redeeming feature. He divided the Christian world into two classes, hypocrites and fools, and asserted that the Bible is a book abounding with vulgar ignorance. Although he respected the teachings of Jesus, he declared his disciples, including Paul, to be a band of dupes and imposters, and had absolutely nothing good to say about priests and preachers, considering them to be the worst kind of con operators.
Christianity is the most perverted system that ever shone on man.
Back in 2003, the Supreme Court upheld a ban on public prayer of any sort at football games and other school-sanctioned events. Those who are bemoaning this triumph of the ungodly fail to mention that those bringing the suit were a Catholic and a Mormon student, neither of whom wanted a member of the evangelical majority praying on their behalf. Remember, many non-denominational churches and evangelicals don't believe Catholics and Mormons are true Christians and actively pray for their salvation. So, of course, we're free to pray, but not so as to forcibly impose our beliefs on others. Because of this, some wring their hands and say, "Our country is doomed," but only those who haven't read their Bibles. Jesus himself points out the public prayers of the Pharisees and calls them self-righteous vipers. Not a really good endorsement of high-profile prayer. The struggle to interpret the Constitution and the Bill of Rights is all part of the continuing process of understanding the huge implications of these documents as we try to mature as a country. Justice Thurgood Marshall's reputation is still impugned by some, in part for his having named the unutterable heresy that the Constitution of the United States was a flawed document at its inception, because it accepted the universal and unacceptable reality of slavery, thus postponing what would take immeasurable blood and generations to address and still not be resolved. Now here's the thing. Thurgood Marshall was joined in this sentiment by an odd ally, George Wallace. When asked what he thought the greatest thing that could have been achieved by the framers of the Constitution was, Wallace replied that he wished they had resolved the issue of slavery back in 1787, so that the trauma of the Civil War and all the difficulties and injustices that have ensued could have been avoided, and all the vast energies of our nation could have been used on other and better purposes. When Thurgood Marshall and George Wallace agree on something, it's a good idea to take note. Under the Constitution, which we rightfully admire, Justice Marshall's ancestors were not only not free, they had no vote, no legal rights that white people were required to acknowledge. And for purely political purposes, they were counted as 3/5 of a white person for the political and economic interests of the South. Under that same instrument, women had a higher station, but no more legal rights. Look, over 230 years later, the Constitution is still holding us together, if barely. And while I agree with Justice Marshall that the Constitution, not unlike the Bible, is a flawed document, I also want to commend it for the freedom it embodies to change, a freedom that has continued to evolve, but has a long way to go toward acknowledging all people's dignity and that all people are endowed with unalienable rights.
In a society where the rights of women are constrained, no man can truly be free. He may have power, but he will not have freedom.
I know that you cannot live on hope alone, but without it, life is not worth living. And you, and you, and you gotta give them hope.
We cannot seek achievement for ourselves and forget about progress and prosperity for our community. Our ambitions must be broad enough to include the aspirations and needs of others, for their sakes and for our own.
Yep, there's a quote from a woman, a gay man, and a Mexican-American. Pretty PC, huh? But the Cesar Chavez quote is not part of some hidden agenda promoting illegal immigration. If you think that, you'd give yourself away as not knowing that much about Cesar Chavez and how he avidly opposed illegal immigration. He marched against it and reported illegal immigrants to the INS. Why? Because illegal immigrants were used as strike breakers when the United Farm Workers were trying to establish a living wage for its members. So simply put, freedom is complicated, and we still have a lot of work to do to practice these unalienable rights. How many of you are Irish, at least on St. Patrick's Day? You remember this? We have high ideals, but we often fall shamefully short.
From African Americans to women, to LGBTQ folks, to Hispanic Latinx people, to Muslims, to the abominable ways that we continue to treat the indigenous people of this continent, we continue to do a lot of talking, but still can't manage to get what unalienable rights mean in practice. It's a good thing the masses yearning to be free are not easily swayed.
The thirst for freedom, the hunger for freedom, the drive to be free dwells deep down within all of us as human beings. And nowhere is that longing seen more clearly than in the calls for systemic change sweeping across the country.
People want to be free, free from prejudice, free from inequality, free from racism.
Our history is full of stories of people who are willing to risk their lives for a taste of what we take for granted.
In the 1850s, Harriet Tubman began as a conductor on the Underground Railroad, making over 15 trips into the South to rescue over 200 slaves and deliver them to freedom. Her journey from slave to Underground Railroad conductor to general as a Union scout to social activist epitomizes the power of real freedom, real dignity, what so many of us take for granted, taking hold in a person's life.
Not for reward, not for recognition, but out of a commitment to freedom that could not be separated from the obligation to foster other people's freedom.
Frederick Douglass wrote to Harriet Tubman in 1868 and eloquently summed up her life.
I have had the applause of the crowd and the satisfaction that comes of being approved by the multitude, while the most that you have done has been witnessed by a few trembling, scared, and footsore bondmen and women whom you have led out of the house of bondage and whose heartfelt God bless you has been your only reward. The midnight sky and the silent stars have been a witness of your devotion to freedom.
For freedom, Christ has set us free. Free to love, to let love be our guide.
For freedom, Christ has set us free, to be servants of one another.
For freedom, Christ has set us free, to pursue happiness not as an end in itself, but as a byproduct of giving of ourselves to all.
If you want to lift yourself up, lift up someone else. That's what our freedom is all about. We're all in this together. We're all free together, and we're all interconnected with one another, dependent on one another, each with unique gifts, resources, and backgrounds.
Some of you know that Arcadia has a giant 4th of July parade every year that begins right in front of my house. Hundreds and hundreds of people with floats and costumes, flags, live music, lots of food, the fire department and lots of politicians, and the mayor of Phoenix jockeying for time in front of one of the many news cameras. Well, because of the virus, this year's parade was canceled.
So I was surprised when on the 4th of July at 7:30 in the morning, there was a growing crowd of uniformed Boy Scouts, their uniformed leaders, and their families congregating in the street and sitting on the low wall at the edge of our yard. Very few masks, no social distancing. So I put on my mask and I went outside. I asked, "Where are your masks?" And people turned around and stared at me like, "Who invited him? We're staying apart. We don't need them outside," and various other mumblings. I said to the scout leaders that with the straight-up spike in Arizona cases, with the county mandate to wear masks, I was surprised that they were putting their kids' health at risk. One of the adults said, "Well, you know, kids aren't susceptible to the virus." "What?" I said. "An 11-year-old died from the virus this week." "Yeah? Where?" "In Florida." And here's where I almost fell over. He said sarcastically, out of 350 million people, one kid dies and you're giving us a hard time? Yeah, in other words, don't tell me what to do. You're infringing on my freedom, and I don't care if it costs someone else their life. Wow.